This episode is brought to you by DigitalOcean, which is designed to help developers build, test, manage, and scale applications of any size easily and faster than ever before. More on that in a bit, but first, on with the show. Welcome to Deep Dive on Startup Snapshot, a Tech in Asia podcast. My name's Nat, and today we're going to be talking about the rising phenomenon of cloud kitchens. The COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated digital adoption for both restaurants and consumers, as more and more people seek online ordering options. Because of that, cloud kitchens are growing in prominence. But what are they and how do they work? Well, it's all in the name. Or at least I think it is. Here's Tech in Asia's Melissa Goh.
Well, is it in the name? It sort of is. I guess cloud kitchens, it's sort of like in the cloud. Well, not the literal cloud, but they have some other names. In some places, they're known as dark kitchens or ghost kitchens. And I think basically, they're kitchens that you don't see.
A cloud kitchen, also known as a dark or ghost kitchen, is a business that owns a space, usually somewhere in a cheap part of a city, and fills that space with kitchens, which then rents out to food operators. It handles all the non-core operations of a food business, from air conditioning, plumbing, and cleaning, to facilitating the pickup of orders. But unlike your typical restaurant, which has a storefront, waiters, and a dine-in area, cloud kitchens just have the kitchen.
It's just back of the kitchen. You have a lean workforce, a couple of staff working in a kitchen that's already provided for you, basic infrastructure. And then from then on, you can just sort of launch a brand, you know, whether that's virtual or whether that's an extension of your actual restaurant that you might already have. And from then on, its sole purpose is to serve food delivery orders rather than, you know, dining. Although, in Singapore, it's a bit different. So some of the cloud kitchens here actually do have dine-in spaces for customers, but I think that's more of an outlier. Like in overseas, it's a pure kitchen.
Since the vertical first came into prominence, a noticeable trend emerged of several cloud kitchens being operated by existing food businesses, specifically food delivery players.
I think the cloud kitchens that we are probably more familiar with are those that are run by, you know, Grab or Deliveroo or Foodpanda. And it's the case in India as well. We've got Swiggy and Zomato, and both are food delivery operators who also run cloud kitchen operators. And I think what's driving them, part of that is a diversification strategy for food delivery operators. The fact that, they are still in a loss-making business, and it's just a way for them to increase efficiencies of the deliveries. You know, if you imagine if you've got one central kitchen serving a bunch of different F&B operators, a delivery guy just has to go there, you know, pick up multiple orders from one place and then send them out, as compared to, you know, going from restaurant A then to B and then to C and picking it up along the way and then sending it to a whole bunch of areas. But having said that, there are also cloud kitchen operators that solely function as that, so they don't provide any form of food delivery services. They leave that up to the restaurants themselves. In Singapore, we've got one of them, and that's called Smart City Kitchens.
There are a couple of benefits to renting out a cloud kitchen. For one, there's the perk of being able to tap into a wide distribution network. Working with Grab Kitchen, for example, gives restaurants instant access to Grab Food's existing user base, who then become the restaurant's customers by proxy. The other benefit cloud kitchens provide is the opportunity for food operators to experiment in new locations.
You know, whether you're new to the F&B business or whether you're an established brand, I think it's a good way of testing the market in a different part of town, or just in a new geographical area, wherever that may be, right? It's like a low-risk way to set up because you don't have to incur the cost of renting a whole restaurant space, doing the renovation, setting that all up. That's basically all handled for you. And also once you're on board the platform, it's a great way to sort of launch virtual brands. What I mean by this is, like, you might be a restaurant selling burgers, but you could also launch a separate brand that maybe serves, you know, Japanese cuisine or something like that, just to test out something completely new, and then sort of test the market.
Right. So how does the whole cloud kitchen phenomenon impact Asia's food industry at large? Is there any wider scale impact that we're seeing?
Okay, I think if you asked this question a few months ago, the answer would have been pretty different because we're in some strange times now. And I think that has, you know, sort of given rise to a whole different kind of consumption behavior among people, you know, whether that's food, you know, everything else, entertainment, e-commerce. I think the food delivery market has definitely been impacted in a big way. Like, people are more receptive now to online delivery methods. And I think restaurants are increasingly recognize that it's a necessary part of doing business. And many are starting to experiment with their own delivery modes, you know, whether that's onboarding themselves to a cloud kitchen, working with third-party delivery services. And food delivery volumes are also up across most of the platforms. So, you know, I think as a whole for the food industry, I think it's hard to isolate the impact of cloud kitchens alone itself. But I think that they would be here to stay for a while. I think one of the operators was actually telling me that it's way easier to onboard merchants now. Like, maybe something like 6 months ago, a lot of restaurant operators still needed a lot of convincing that, you know, hey, you should onboard with us. You should, you know, experiment, try out food delivery. I think it's just, you know, the evolution of food industry in general and the evolution of consumer dining behavior. And as I talked about earlier, a diversification strategy of food delivery operators, I don't think it's going to stop there. In fact, I think we're going to see, you know, much more innovation around this.
But there's another side to the phenomenon that could potentially pose major risks to restaurants that decide to work with them, which a number of businesses have said put them off of renting a cloud kitchen. More on that after the break, but first, a quick word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the cloud provider whose predictable pricing, flexible configurations, and world-class customer support give you access to all the infrastructure services you need to grow. Here are some pros and cons that Bobby Johnson, co-founder of a company called Madness Labs, wrote online. Pros: easy to set up, extremely affordable, and you can upgrade hardware on the fly. Cons: none I can think of. Huh. I have had multiple hosts and none have stacked up to the flexibility and ease of use. So, what are you waiting for? Get started on DigitalOcean for free at do.co/deepdive. That's do.co/deepdive. And now, back to the show. Welcome back to Deep Dive. Before the break, we talked about the rise of cloud kitchens and why they're an appealing prospect for restaurateurs who want to expand their business and food delivery operators who want to diversify their revenue streams. But just as quickly as the vertical came into prominence, so too did dissenting opinions on cloud kitchens' impact on food businesses.
So there's certainly been a lot of restaurants who have tried opening a cloud kitchen at one of these facilities under the promise of lower costs, but often there's a catch. So there are actually exclusivity clauses that means that if you are, for example, if you're operating at a cloud kitchen operated by Foodpanda, you can only use the delivery services that Foodpanda offer. And I think that's a huge limiting factor for many people, because if you have to rely on only one food delivery operator, one food delivery distribution network, this sort of limits the market that you can serve. And I think where it gets tricky is that, you know, if restaurants end up being completely reliant on this distribution network of these platforms, especially if they're new and they've never had a storefront, this means, you know, they have yet to sort of build a following of their own customers. Then when this happens, what really sets your, you know, burger chain apart from maybe tens of other burger chains on a food delivery platform, right? Where is the brand loyalty if a customer has never even heard of you, if you're just a virtual brand? That's when it gets tricky, because you just become a name in a sea of thousands of other names, and you're just easily and highly substitutable, right, to the next burger brand who might be offering, you know, promotions and things like that. Also, I think if you've never met your customer before and they only come through, you know, Foodpanda or Deliveroo platforms, you basically don't own that customer relationship. And when that happens, you are basically at the mercy of these cloud kitchen operators or food delivery platforms, because if you're fully reliant on them, what happens when they hike fees or increase commission rates or even launch their own brands to compete with yours?
So is that something that is going to change, or is that something that's simply a characteristic of working with cloud kitchens?
I would say it's definitely something that's common, well, not just in Singapore, but in other markets like India as well. It's normal for them to impose such exclusivity clauses. And I think that's just part of the business model, right? How do you attract and retain F&B operators on your platform? Of course, you've got cloud kitchen operators that are delivery platform agnostic. We talked about smart city kitchens earlier. They're actually pretty neutral that way. So F&B operators operating at their facility can, you know, just set up whatever kinds of food delivery methods that they want. But then again, that's just one operator out of a whole bunch of other cloud kitchen operators which are still being operated by your food delivery companies. So in that way, I don't see how that's going to change in a big way, simply because it's a competitive market and you have to sort of control your market share in some way.
And sometimes the promise of lower costs isn't entirely true as well. On Melissa's article on the topic, a reader named Jason Williams chimed in with his perspective. He said, "I own 3 restaurants in Singapore operating under one brand. We decided not to go with any of the cloud kitchens because in addition to the 30% royalty fees, the 2% fee, and the lack of interaction with customers, the rental prices are 3 to 4 times higher than comparable rates when you look at a per square foot basis. Owners will be paying $30 per square foot for a space that would otherwise cost $10 per square foot if they invested in their own space. Cloud kitchens do not make sense on many levels." Did you happen to actually see the comment on your article by the Jason Williams?
I did.
Is that just his experience, or is that something that you would actually have seen across the board? Like, some of these cloud kitchens actually have higher rentals than just having your own area?
Yeah, so one of the challenges I came across is that it's hard to compare the cost structures of a cloud kitchen and a restaurant side by side, right? Because it's like comparing apples to oranges, because it's totally different. And I think for some it makes sense, and for some in Jason's case, but I definitely think he's not alone. I did speak to Ichiban Bento. They're a casual Japanese restaurant chain which also signed up as a tenant at I think Foodpanda's facilities here. And one of the things they said is that even though they save on labor costs because of a leaner workforce at these premises, they are paying much higher fees overall. And I think that's a function of the commission rates that food delivery companies are charging on every order. So I think that varies a lot from one cloud kitchen to another. And I think definitely there are restaurants for whom like this makes sense, and for others, we talked about how, you know, if you are limited to the customers of only one food delivery network, that really limits your sales as well. So I think, yeah, it is a function of your restaurant name, how established your ADR, the promotions that you run. So I think it's really case by case. So for Jason's case, it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for many others as well, but I'm sure there are some other brands as well which, you know, the cost revenue structures did make sense for them.
Right. So I guess it's because it's not just the rental fees, but it's also taking into account the commission and all your extra spend when you're working with a cloud kitchen, right?
Yeah. And in fact, some, I think Deliveroo doesn't even charge a rental fee. Basically, whatever they charge is just a percentage of the revenue of total orders.
Despite the ramifications it will have on individual food businesses, the growing prominence of cloud kitchen services could have far-reaching effects across other industries within the startup ecosystem.
Well, firstly, I think it definitely hits F&B operators the most because of all the reasons that we discussed earlier. Especially if this takes on a larger scale, I think they're going to be seeing a lot more cost efficiencies, especially when it comes down to food deliveries, because the food delivery part of it is actually one of the most costly parts of running a food delivery platform business. And I think for your third-party providers like Lalamove, for example, I think they do stand to benefit overall as well if the food delivery ecosystem is, you know, healthy and people are getting used to ordering food online.
But it's difficult to tell how exactly cloud kitchens will impact the wider ecosystem, or even how the vertical itself will evolve in the future.
I spoke to an industry analyst, Satish Meena from Forrester, and he was actually saying that, you know, before the pandemic, delivery orders in India across the different operators was averaging about 100 million a month. And that's a lot. And, you know, ever since then, that's actually decreased to a fifth of that 20 million because people are becoming more cautious about making contact with like a food delivery drivers even. And I think then it also boils down to the question of, you know, who needs who more, right? Do F&B operators rely on these cloud kitchen facilities, or, you know, is it the cloud kitchens and the food delivery platforms who run such cloud kitchens that need F&B operators to survive and for them to scale the business? So I think, you know, in terms of how sustainable it is, I think it really depends on, you know, in the long run, whether merchants are able to demand the terms and fees that make sense for them. And it also depends on what kind of alternatives they have out there. You know, if not cloud kitchens, then what? You know, are there good enough third-party food delivery options available out there that they can explore? We talked about this earlier as well, and I think food delivery platforms are still a loss-making business, and things like cloud kitchens is just one of their diversification strategies, right? You've got a whole lot of other businesses. We're seeing things like food delivery platforms going into grocery deliveries even. So I think it's a way of diversifying revenues, and I think as long as the economics of that makes sense, I think we are going to see cloud kitchens being around for a while, and we might even see, you know, new services coming up.
For more stories like this one, visit techin.asia/sub, where you'll get access to all the latest in-depth news on the Asian tech and startup ecosystem. You can also subscribe to this podcast, where we've published a number of other deep dive episodes over the past few months that you can check out. But that's it for this run of Deep Dive, for now at least. In a couple of weeks, we'll be launching a weekly news show featuring the top news on Tech in Asia for the week. So keep a lookout for that. If you want to reach out to us, you can email podcast@techinasia.com or comment on whatever platform you're on. I want to know what you think. Did you like Deep Dive? Would you prefer it to our regular Startup Snapshot run? What do you think of us switching to a weekly news format? Let me know all your thoughts. That's all for this week. Special thanks to Melissa Goh for joining me today, and a big thanks once more to DigitalOcean for sponsoring today's episode and the three episodes before this. You can check out its website in the show notes. Till next time, my name's Nat. I'll see you in a couple weeks.